we just kind of made a decision that in order to sort of lively things up a little bit, rather than go into another story that we're going to tell to you, let's take a little time to hear some of your questions and have a little more dialogue than we've been having to try to kind of get us all awake. I want to start with the first question that was asked about asthma in Cuba and the treatment of asthma. The Cubans are, they also suffer a lot of asthma, especially in the city of Havana, which, because they use a lot of diesel fuel, and the air can be kind of congested from the industrial pollution. But outside of the city, it's not as much of a problem. They work to treat it in many of the same ways that they do here in the U.S., but they have difficulty getting the medicines, the inhalers, because the U.S. blockade prevents a lot of the medications that are used in the U.S. or used, you know, manufactured by U.S. corporations from reaching Cuba. So one of the important pieces of aid that we've brought to Cuba with some of our caravans has been inhalers for asthma. But they work on centralizing the treatment. Not everybody has a little inhaler that they carry in their pocket or in their house. But if you go to the neighborhood polyclinic, which is never too far away from where you live, you can go and hook up to get a hit off the big tank that they have. And so you get your medicine that way. If you can't get it in your home, they make sure that it's still available to you. So it's not easy, but it is available in terms of the, you know, the treatment opportunities.
But the treatment is basically the same as it is here.
Pretty much. They're looking at some natural methods that they can use, and they do stress relief, and they use a lot of acupuncture. They use herbs when they can. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what specifically they use for asthma, I think they still rely on the same chemicals we rely on here when they're available. What other kinds of questions do people have? Lou, you want to come up also and...
Someone back there?
That's Karen.
I'm going to add one unique thing that they do about asthma, which is that the same sort of camp by the beach that in Tarara, where they treat the Chernobyl, the children who have been affected by Chernobyl, every summer for decades has been used as a summer camp for children with asthma and diabetes. For them to learn, because to keep parents from being overprotective, and children with asthma or diabetes, very often the parents are overprotective because they think, oh, well, you can't do this and you can't do that. And they have a summer camp where they learn how to take care of themselves. They learn how to do all the exercises, the breathing. They play all the kinds of games and do all the sports and do things that other kids do. So they get a sense of themselves, not as invalids, but as functioning human beings. And that's every summer.
Down here was a question.
Yeah, a two-part question.
Stand up so everybody can hear, then we don't have to repeat.
I guess it was said that the Cuban government offers 500 scholarships per year to U.S. students, and I guess, did I hear that only 100 are actually enrolled right now? Is that just because we haven't been able to find enough people, or, all right. And when it's 500 per year, is that 500, they are committed to admitting 500 per year, or enrolling 500 per year at various stages?
Okay, so the question is about the offer of the 500 scholarships. When President Castro spoke at Riverside Church in New York, he said that they would make 500 spaces available in the school for students from the U.S. This is alongside of 28 other countries that also have students enrolled in the program. And it wasn't 500 per year, but it was 500 at first until those 500 are filled, and then when there are 500, we talk about space for even more students than that. Now, they offered 500 scholarships in September of 2000, and they were ready to have 500 students be there on campus in April of 2001. They actually got to go to the campus to take photographs so that we could do some prep work to let people know what the place looked like, and they showed me where the 500 beds were. But we needed to explain to them about the reality of the U.S. situation. First of all, we have to publicize the offer. We have to make people aware of what it is, really. We have to overcome whatever propaganda there is about Cuba, and is it okay to go and study in Cuba? We have to make sure that people who enroll in the program are going to be able to practice medicine in the U.S. when they come back, and that's going to take some research. And the students, those of you who are applying, you need to do your applications, get your transcripts. The transcripts have to be sent a certain way. You need recommendation letters. When you get admitted to the program, you need to give notice on your jobs. You need to give up your place to live, you know, all that kind of thing. So we had to explain that it's a period of time that's going to take longer in terms of the actual enrollment process, even if there were 500 people who were interested from the get-go. In addition to that, this is a very self-selecting program. And we need, as much as we talk about the beauty of it, we need also to be mindful that students who decide to go and study in Cuba are going to be living in pretty basic conditions. We're giving up a lot of creature comforts to be there. You know, people call us sometimes and say, oh, are there private bathrooms in the dormitories? And it's not like that. You know, you're living in a dorm that used to be a Naval Academy barracks, and you're living in bunk beds with a lot of other people around. You have to give up a certain amount of privacy. You have to get used to eating rice and beans a lot, mm-hmm. and a lot more than you do even now. So not everybody wants to do that. Not everybody wants to go study in another country. Not everybody is going to be ready for the challenge of studying in Spanish. But for those who are ready to take on those challenges, the opportunity is incomparable. So we never expected we were going to see 500 people jump up right away. Now that the program is growing, we're expecting to see more and more applicants. Now that the media is covering it a little bit more, now that the first graduate of the program has been awarded his residency at Montefiore Hospital in New York. And we know that other students are passing the STEP exams and that it is a reality, it is possible that the students are going to do well enough and the medical community in the U.S. is going to be receptive enough that the people who come out of this program are going to come back and be able to do the work that they went there to get ready to do. We expect that we're going to see it grow. And when we hit the 500 number, then there'll be even more spaces available. But that also depends on meetings like this one and the folk here in this community and other communities spreading the word. Because all of you heard about this from a flyer or a teacher or from something on the internet, but maybe 6 months ago you didn't know it existed. So we have to keep spreading the word. Did you want to say more?
That's okay. Any other questions? Yes.
How does the scarcity of resources or the lack of technology affect you within those 6 years that you're out of the country when you return?
What the students say, and what we've seen from looking very closely at Cuban medicine, is that the scarcity of resources, the absence of things like asthma inhalers and some of the particular medical technology and equipment that gets affected because of the U.S. blockade, you know, the machines that they can't repair. They might be using older X-ray machines than we are. They have MRI machines, but they don't have 3 MRI machines in every hospital. The resources are more centralized, so you don't get maybe as much hands-on experience with some of that. What the Cubans said about that, first of all, is that it makes them better doctors because they have to learn to do more with their hands. Mm-hmm. And it makes them better equipped to learn how to do a diagnosis without a lot of fancy bells and whistles. And they've been saying that from the very beginning. They've been saying that since 92 when the economy collapsed and there were really pretty much no medicines on the shelves for a period of some years. And we would go visit a family doctor's clinic and the doctor would say, well, yeah, you know, it's hard to get aspirin and it's hard to get this and it's hard to get just about everything. But we learned, and then we'd walk out into the yard with them, we learned that if we boil the bark on this orange tree, we can make a really good cough syrup and we can use this to make a poultice and we can do this and this and this. The emphasis on clinical training and on what you do in a lower technology situation is the thing that you learn in Cuba that you don't learn in the U.S. In the U.S., you learn how to call out for a whole bunch of tests. And we've heard from a lot of the students in the program that in the hospitals and the communities that they come from, they don't have access to all those tests anyway. And you know the point where somebody comes into the doctor's office and says, well, I have this ache and pain, and the doctor says, well, you need this, 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 and the patient doesn't ever come back because they don't have the insurance to do the next steps. The Cuban method is to teach you how to work without all the bells and whistles. And in the meanwhile, you see their ingenuity as they're developing their own bells and whistles. They're learning how to create new technology that works better in situations with a lower amount of resources. One example, at the Neurology Institute, they're working on what amounts to basically a low-technology brain scan. something you can only do with an MRI or a CAT scan machine, which you know is a tremendously expensive piece of equipment in the U.S. They're learning how to do, it looks like a personal computer with a bunch of wires attached to a shower cap. And you can put it on, you get a really good picture of the brain. And it's completely portable. You can take it into the bush. You can take it any place. You don't have to have a fancy hospital. So you can do the diagnostic work that you can't do here without the fancy equipment. So there's a trade-off. And what we've heard is that what the students are telling us and what the doctors are telling us also in the program is that they give you all the preparation and all the technical training and give you a limited time with the equipment. And then as you come back in the summertime and work in hospitals in the U.S. or when you start your residency in the U.S., it just takes a very short time to integrate what you've learned there with the particular models of the machinery you'll be using at home. What other questions?
Just a couple of additions to what Alan said. Our students tell us that they feel they're learning diagnostic skills in a much more fundamental and basic way, and it enables them to work in the most difficult and scarce of situations. There is training provided at certain levels for the use of some of the imaging technology and other technical equipment. Those may not be available or will not be available at the neighborhood clinic levels that we referred to earlier. But as you'll be hearing later, the way the healthcare system in Cuba is structured, the neighborhood clinics all have access to polyclinics, and the polyclinics have a higher level of technology, technical equipment. And then there are specialty hospitals that even the polyclinics can refer persons to. And this isn't cumbersome. There's not a lot of bureaucracy. You don't have to, wait 2 days, like in New York, to get admitted from emergency to a ward. This is sort of rapid progression up the system, because the system is designed to maximize care and as rapid a method as possible for people who have needs for special diagnoses or for operations. And then the other thing to remember is that Cuba has specialized in providing all of the necessary technology, but it may not be available every place. It has gone even beyond a lot of the communities in the U.S. They have a biotechnological genetic engineering institute. Well, really, there are about 23 institutes within the complex. So in Cuba, you have available, rather readily available, services from the basic neighborhood clinic level to the level of high-tech biological and genetic engineering. It's a question of whether all of that's available in one hospital or not. It's not generally. It's available within the structure of the healthcare system. Other questions? Yes.
When do the U.S. students take the exams, the U.S. exams? Do they travel to the U.S. or can they take it there?
The question is, when and where do the U.S. students take the licensing exams, the U.S. MLEs?
Right, yes. all the different parts.
Yes. The U.S. students have been taking the exam. Some of them have been preparing to take the Step 1 exam after the second year of study. More of them are waiting to take it after the third year. In the U.S., after 2 years of medical school basic sciences, that's traditionally when just about everybody takes the Step exams. In the Cuban program, there's a longer period of time in the clinical training, and a lot of the U.S. students are saying that first year of clinical training in third year gives them a chance to better integrate what they learned in the classroom with hands-on experience. And it also gives them a little more time to study for the STEP exams and to prepare, because in the first 2 years of the curriculum, you've got a really heavy course load, and you're studying in Spanish. And then you need to make time on top of that to come back and do the step preparation in English. So more of the students are taking the step one in third year or after third year, preparing at some point there. And the step two, the different parts, the students who've taken that so far have done that in fourth, fifth, sixth year. They don't offer the test in Cuba. You can take it in the U.S. anywhere, or you can take it at a Kaplan Center anywhere. So I understand if you wanted to take the test in Jamaica or some other places, you could. But you can take it in any place in the U.S. when you are ready to sign up to do it.
So you basically study there while you're attending school?
Yes. And
there is help there? Do English or American teachers? Not teachers, but is there people who have experience?
You want to answer that?
Who has the the components of the test and what to study for?
Okay. There's several parts to sort of a multiple question. The tests are not offered in Cuba. That's not Cuba's decision. You got to remember that these steps, that the STEP program is a U.S. phenomenon. It's not replicated in other countries. But there are selected offshore places where the step may be taken, and as Ellen mentioned, Jamaica is one of those, Mexico, there are a number of other countries where the steps may be taken, but Cuba is simply not one of them. So the U.S. students tend to take the steps in the U.S. None have yet chosen to take it in Mexico or Jamaica, although that's a possibility. The second part, I think, of your question is how they prepare in Cuba. I think Carol mentioned that our committee, the scholarship, IFCO Scholarship Committee, has encouraged the development of study groups in Cuba, the information to support the students in the study by the Cuban instructors have been provided by us. We've talked with them about the integration in the courses of the materials that will be covered in the steps. So there is an increasing approach to providing supports within the curriculum at the school and some extracurricular activities such as the study groups that are not in the curriculum, but they're provided space for meeting and resources in the form of books and some participation by Cuban instructors. So all of that is available in Cuba. But there are a number of students, an increasing number of U.S. students, who return to the U.S. and take one of the prep courses, not exclusively, but primarily Kaplan. They do that during the summer, and some of them have taken a leave for a semester or for a year in order to study, in order that they might take the steps. So there are a variety of resources available and a variety of methods that are used by the students to access the steps.
Sometimes they take a semester or a year off. If they do take a semester off, then when they go back to Cuba, they just pick up where they left off. That means you'll spend one more semester longer. Or is that, do you have to wait for the next year to continue?
If you're taking a full year, then it's a full year sequence in terms of the course of study. But when you get into fourth and fifth year, you have a series of short rotations and you have some flexibility there. You can take off for a couple of rotations, maybe return to school in October instead of the beginning of September, maybe even the beginning of November, and make up those rotations during the following summer. So some students are opting to do that because you have that flexibility. In earlier years, you don't have that flexibility. You need to do the full year sequence of the courses. And if you stay out for a certain time, then you come back the next year and start where you left off. But let me say another word about the STEP exams, because it's an important theme. This whole issue of standardized testing and how it relates to medical education is something that's real important just to lift up for a second. The standardized tests, which are multiple choice, grueling, detail-oriented, challenging, difficult kinds of tests, are used, as we all know, as gatekeepers that have prevented access not only to medical education but to many different kinds of education to a lot of folk who are known as non-traditional quote-unquote students. And we're talking in large part about students of color, students who come from non-white mainstream cultural environments, students who've had different sorts of educational preparation. And that's been ingrained in our whole educational system for years and years. And it's something that we take seriously because we agree with the Cubans that, first of all, our country certainly needs more doctors, and second of all, education and healthcare are basic human rights that should be available to everyone. I want to tell you that there was a time that we had a conversation with one of the administrators of the Latin American School of Medicine, who we work with very closely, and we were talking about the STEP exams. And he said he had been to Illinois once to visit a university there, and the doctors there were telling him about the STEP exam, and they described that you need to go and sit in a little cubicle by yourself with a computer and answer an hour of multiple-choice questions, and then another hour of multiple-choice questions, and then another hour, and then another. And all of it very arcane little bits of information that you may or may not encounter in your actual work as a doctor. And he shook his head and he said, you know, where I come from, we would call that a human rights violation. Because in Cuba, they wouldn't think of subjecting someone to that kind of testing. It doesn't make sense to them that that's a way to evaluate how good someone's going to be as a doctor. And what they say is that those are tests that are designed to exclude people rather than to include people. They're tests to try to get as many people to fail as possible. And we understand that helping folk to succeed in this process is about getting over that hurdle. And that's why there are study groups set up at the school. One of the reasons that more of the students are taking the STEP exam, the first step in the third year, is that now on the campus where the students do the clinical studies, they've set up a computer lab, they're doing practice tests in English, they're getting more resources available. Another important thing is that we've been able to bring some learning specialists to come and work with the students to do workshops with them about test anxiety and about the strategies that you need in order to succeed in the tests, which is a whole different thing from how good a doctor you are. The training in Cuba, besides being in Spanish, is very hands-on, and many of the exams are oral exams. And they just don't do a lot of multiple-choice tests, because that's not how they think about how doctors need to think. But then you got to come back and do these tests in the U.S. So people like Hai Doyle, who is Associate Dean at King Drew, and who is a learning specialist in working with non-traditional students. He goes to the MMEP programs in the summer. He runs workshops in the U.S. during the year to help students find strategies for how to think through how to take these exams. Another specialist we know who works in this area is my cousin Ben Bernstein, Dr. Ben Bernstein, who's sitting here in the back of the room. He lives here in Oakland. I'm so happy that he's here with us. He's a psychologist who specializes also in that field, and we're hoping to get him more involved in giving support to the students as they go to take the exams. So, a little more information.
Yes.
Have students found it challenging to take the information that they learn in Spanish while at the University in Cuba and then take something like the STEP exam that's in English,
Yeah. The question is, do students find it challenging to convert from studying in Spanish to then taking the exams in English? And we need to tell you that the U.S. students, when they're among themselves, are speaking English almost all the time in the dorm, and that in addition to having, which may or may not be a good thing, it doesn't help with their Spanish immersion, but it does help them with converting back and forth.
That brings up another question, actually. Are the students integrated with students from the other countries in the dorms?
The way that the school sets up the dormitories, each nationality has its own space to live. And there is some mixing. The reason the Cubans decided that is that they felt that while students were far away from home, it was really important for everybody to maintain their support group, their sense of national identity, their ties and connections with home. And they see each of the national delegations kind of developing cohesion and unity. But in the dorm where the U.S. students live, there are also Latino students. There are students from Belize. Most of them are from English-speaking countries. There are a few African students as well. And they're right next to all the dorms with all the other students, and everybody is together in classes and dining halls and stuff. But the other part of your question about switching back and forth, we try to make English language textbooks available so that the students can practice and check themselves and make sure that they're understanding things well. Later on in the curriculum, all of the Spanish-speaking students study English, because so much of the medical literature internationally is available in English. So everybody needs to know English our students can use that time to study other things that they need to do and to prepare for the STEP exams. Other questions?
I've been trying to do research, and I can't really find what's the main reason that the U.S. is blocking Cuban.
That's the $64,000 question, and there are many different ways to answer it, and one way we answer it sometimes is that people in the U.S. government don't want us to be able to find out that it's possible to have universal health care. And part of it is preventing people in the U.S. from learning about the positive example that Cuba provides in terms of health and education and social welfare and all the different services that are provided, because their system is fundamentally so different from ours in its intentions. But the actual blockade of Cuba...
political.
Lucius, you tell that story.
I hope you all heard the question. She's been studying, researching, trying to find out why this U.S. blockade exists. What's the reason for it? All of you should do that. Constantly you should be studying and trying to discern and understand why the blockade exists. Woven throughout the day will be answers to that question. You heard Alicia's take on it in the first presentation, her opening. Basically she said, the U.S. doesn't want us to see the truth about Cuba. That's a simple and direct and clear answer to your question. It'll come out in various ways, so be on the alert. Be listening. Let me give you an example that might help open some eyes. I want to give you an example by making a contrast between Haiti and Cuba. They're about 50 miles apart. And in Haiti, there is rampant poverty and a totally fractured healthcare system. In Cuba, they've learned how to share their scarcity. So there is no abject poverty. There's want, there are problems, but they learn how to share that. No matter whether you're a doctor, an engineer, or a farmer, there is a control in the range of difference in income. They all have to go to the same market for rationed vegetables. There is a sense of equality. Never find that in Haiti. Healthcare in Cuba, of course, is one of its signatures. It's we know it's universal and it's free. Not in Haiti. Labor. People in Haiti, they feel lucky sometimes if they find a job at a U.S. corporation which has transferred from the U.S. to Haiti and pay, well, a so-called good wage. It's $2.35 per
day.
Per day.
18 hours.
Per day. With no insurance, health insurance, no safe working conditions. Even if they buy lunch at a little cafeteria, they pay for that out of the $2.35. That could never happen in Cuba. There is a labor union. There's a thing called minimum wage. Healthcare is provided free. Safe working conditions on the job. Respect for the workers. Maternity leave, if you leave in Haiti, you lose your job. If you leave for maternity reasons in Cuba, you're assured to return to your job after, what is it, 6 months or is it nine?
Well, you get 4 months that are paid.
4 months paid.
And you can stay the whole first year of your child's life with your job guaranteed when you come back. Okay. And one day off a month for pediatric visits.
And we could do a whole session, a whole class on the comparisons. But what I'm basically saying is that in Cuba, there are fundamental commitments to the protections of the workers, to guaranteed health care, education, universal and free, and not in Cuba, not in, and that's not true. You don't have those guarantees in Haiti, you have those guarantees in Cuba. Now, when you consider $2.35 for products that are made, paid per hour for the worker, per day for the worker, at the end of the day, at the end of the assembly line, there's a certain product. Okay, those products sell on the world market for the same amount they used to sell for when the factory was in Sacramento or Oakland or New York or some other city in the U.S. But they didn't have to pay as much for the material. They didn't have to pay as much for the labor. Somebody is making windfall profit. And it doesn't, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to begin to calculate that there are millions of dollars being acquired by corporate owners at the expense of the workers. That could never happen in Cuba. Healthcare is not a private business. It's a human right. Education is not in Cuba. It's not a business. It's a human right. There's no possibility that U.S. corporations could make the kind of windfall profits in Cuba that they make in Haiti, in Jamaica, throughout the Caribbean, Mexico. So someone is economically benefiting from the exploitation of workers around the world. Cuba rests on its sovereignty. It has laws to protect its people, and it will not allow U.S. corporations to go in and buy companies and operate. And that sends chills up the spines of U.S. corporations. They want a market and a climate in which they can operate with freedom to exploit and to make windfall profits. So it's the U.S. corporations that are alongside the right-wing Cuban Americans that are driving the U.S. policy to try to overthrow the government of Cuba and to make it a favorable climate for U.S. corporations to reap windfall profits. That's just one little example, but there are many answers to your question, and we'll be talking about them in various ways today. It's another way to say it is Cuba is a good example that the U.S. doesn't want other poor nations to see.
My question, what I was going to say, relate to what he was saying when he was comparing Haiti and Cuba. I'm from Haiti, so what I wanted to say was, yes, the difference he's saying is true, that the difference between the economic and the public health difference in Haiti and Cuba are very drastic, very big. One reason why, it's not because the Haitian people do not want that, do not want a social government where people are able to obtain care and jobs. The difference is because the U.S. is not in Cuba anymore. I mean, that's why the embargo exists. Haiti is basically run by the U.S. Any government that Haiti, any democratic government or any movement that exists or coming, that rising in Haiti has been crushed by the U.S. over and over again, and that's why there was a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Not because the people do not want that, the country to be ruled and controlled by their own, but because the U.S. is, mm-hmm. presence of the U.S. is so strong in Haiti. And in Cuba, that's why Cuba is viewed as an evil person by the U.S. media, because he defines the U.S. Yes. over and over. Mm-hmm. That's why there's a difference.
The history being that in the 1950s the U.S. did control Cuba.
Right.
There was a dictator in place. The whole economy was run by the U.S. and Cuba was like a playground for folk who wanted to go and use Cuban women as prostitutes, use Cuban resources as a wasteland, just as a playground for them. When and the sugar and all of the resources of the country were exploited for U.S. interests. And when the Cubans said no to that in 1959, the U.S. still has not gotten up off its frustration about that. Who was next?
Have there been students accepted to the medical school without certain college, certain college level science classes or courses?
You want to do that, or should I? Initially, when the program was offered to students from the U.S., the question was about, have students enrolled in the program without college-level sciences? Initially, when the Cubans made the offer, they said it's for students from 18 to 25 years of age and with a bachiller degree, which we understood was a high school degree in Latin America. So we thought, oh, 18 years old in high school, that's fine, and made the offer available to students at that level of preparation and found that when they got to Cuba, they were struggling a lot with the sciences. Some of them did okay, some of them did not do so well. And what we came to understand is that a bachiller degree, although it's a high school degree, it's a pre-university high school degree, and it really sort of amazed us to find out that high school level sciences in Guatemala, high school level sciences in places in Latin America are so far superior to what people learn in high school science in the United States. That we had to say, you know, it's a question about inner city and rural high schools. It's a question about how much information do you all have access to here. So we started to have to say that students from the US need to show you don't have to have a bachelor's degree. You have the option to finish the BA degree if you want to or not. But you do have to show us that you can do the college level sciences. And that's 1 year of biology, 1 year of chemistry, one year of inorganic chemistry, 1 year of organic chemistry, 1 year of physics, all of that with lab.
So if you do a few years of science already, you would just be placed ahead when you get there.
It's not that you're placed ahead, it's that those are the minimum requirements in order to step up to the next step, which is medical school level sciences. You don't get advanced, if you've done medical school in the US, you get advanced placement, if you can show that your transcripts are equivalent. And there have been one or two students who have done that. But for the most part, no. There's a pre-med semester that's offered at the Cuban school, as Carol mentioned before, but that's really a refresher course for people who've had some pre-med sciences and need to kind of get up to the level to make sure that they're ready to do first year in the fall. You want the other two questions too?
Sure, go ahead.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Thank you, everything that you've done to even have this opportunity.
Don't worry.
Oh, opportunity in the first place. I realize that it's exceptional. But just to play devil's advocate a little bit, if I was going to be graduate from Harvard from medical school, how would my training as in Cuba help me to do as much, if not more, for people in the Tenderloin or people in East Oakland who have issues, a couple with that homelessness and poverty, but trauma from all of the things that they've experienced in their lives? Crack. I don't know that people deal with drug issues like that in Cuba, but those different kinds of issues, or if I were to travel to practice medicine in Haiti or Africa, how would my training in Cuba be better or equivalent to the training that I would have at a premier medical institution here, coupled with the same kinds of networking resources that I would have going to those places and being able to get things that I would need or get all the different kinds of support that I would need.
Okay, while the third question is being asked, I want to ask Dr. Richard Quinn to come up here because he might have to help us with that second question. Yes?
I wondered about the focus, more detail, and
detail?
How Western it is or alternative.
Detail.
Wonderful answers.
What's detail?
And I'm
more detailed.
Curious about nutrition, how much that is taught, and questions like cholesterol and how you address that in school.
You heard what she said.
Yeah, I did. Okay. Should we start with that end or with the particulars here? Okay. The question that you're asking dovetails a little bit with your question. A lot of the focus in Cuban medical training is on primary and preventive care. And everyone says that there's not nearly enough of that offered in any medical training system in the United States. They do teach alternative methods. The system is mostly focused on traditional Western medicine. And they say that to everybody because Cuba is known around the world as having developed certain alternatives now, in part because of the scarcity that they developed because of the blockade when their economy collapsed in the early 90s. And all of a sudden they couldn't get antibiotics and they were using more acupuncture and they were using more Eastern and more traditional and natural kinds of treatments that they were developing as they went along and learning from other parts of the world. They incorporate that into their treatment modalities all the time. Every neighborhood polyclinic has an aromatherapy clinic and a mud therapy clinic and heat therapy and physical therapy and all kinds of things. You learn to do that, but it's not the major part of your training. You learn to be a traditional Western doctor with all of that also. But the focus is on the primary preventive care. And that's a piece that you might not get at Harvard. At Harvard, you might get to meet the millionaires who can give you the grant to open your clinic in the Tenderloin. But you're probably not going to get some of the mentality that you need to really think about how to provide the care and make it available. We heard a story recently about public health physicians from Harvard who went to visit Cuba. And when they first got there, they were rolling their eyes a little bit because you go to the family doctor's clinic and you just see, you know, a room with a baby scale and a stethoscope and some real basic equipment. And you don't have fancy computers, fancy equipment, fancy anything. And the doctors in the family clinic started to show the Harvard folk how they kept their medical records, all of it done pencil and paper. But, you know, this is patient so-and-so, and this is what happened to them on this date, and this is the last time we saw them, and here are the other people in the family. This is who's smoking. This is who has diabetes. This is how long since they've been to see us. This is when we went to see them. Mm-hmm. And one by one, the doctors from Harvard were saying, this is exactly what we're trying to teach our students to learn how to do in public health. But nobody does that in the U.S. So you get that mentality. They, in Cuba, they're not going to have hands-on experience dealing with a crack addict population because they don't have that in Cuba. But they're going to know what it takes to do the community outreach, how to work with a multidisciplinary team, how to deal with all the medical conditions that you need. And they're going to give you whatever support and connections to go and do that work and the chance to meet with people internationally who are dealing with those issues as well. So that's part of the answer to your question. You want to
answer the third question?
The third question was about nutrition. No, is that, okay. I'm sorry, the third question. Shall I do that also? Yes,
no,
I can.
No, I'll just find it.
No.
Just,
I touched on the first two. Did you get the answer you need?
Pardon me. Okay. Lillian?
Yes.
Do you have a follow-up? Are you clear? Are you satisfied with this answer?
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. It seems like inevitably, more so in the treatment style than in the actual like diagnosing or the model, mm-hmm. that I would have exposure to that type of thing. And I interpret it to almost kind of be a little bit like osteopathy, even maybe. Like the diagnosis integrated into that also? Is my problem solving in the primary care learning model?
Yeah, I think we tend to think that way.
Okay.
And in the U.S., that the folk who are a little more holistic in their diagnostic procedures, sometimes we say, well, that's more like osteopathy. Okay. But it's very medical, but it's also very humane and very socially oriented. And also you're working with many doctors who have had international experience. So the doctors who will be teaching you have not only worked in Cuba, and they learn about homelessness, and they learn about other disease entities, and they learn about drug problems when they go to work in the other countries that Cuba has served. So they do have that clinical experience, and they'll talk with you about that and share with you about the rotations that you do when, you know, the externships you do when you're back at home.
Okay. Those of you who may be interested in comparing medical education in the U.S. and abroad, especially in Cuba, you may want to talk with Dr. Quinn. He's offered to be available if you have private questions or if you have small group discussions along this line.
Sure, let me just say one thing. The question you ask about the differences in medical training in the U.S. medical schools and in Cuba. Let me say, first of all, I'm a retired faculty member from UCSF, so I've taught at the medical school level here, and I've been going to Cuba since 1978, so I think I understand the two systems. It's very possible in the U.S. to learn and appreciate and train in the public health model, but the key difference is that U.S. students have to seek it out, and in Cuba, it's just part of the program. So a very narrow range of students in the United States who are attending U.S. medical schools will get some of those same kinds of training, but still not embedded in a culture and a system in which it's the everyday fabric of life.
That's helpful.
I should tell you that two of the students who are currently enrolled in the school are going to be arriving soon, and we'll integrate them into the discussion. We also have a film which Alicia will introduce and describe a little later that we'll be showing during lunch. So we're just trying to give you a sense of what the schedule is like. We realize that there may be some of you who are reluctant to ask questions publicly and you'd like to talk more privately with people. One of the reasons I introduced the members of the committee and the medical doctor who's here, Dr. Quinn, is in order that you can seek people out, or of course any of us, to ask questions. I want to just briefly introduce another person that you might seek out privately or individually to talk to. Her name is Karen Wall. Stand up, Karen. She's a U.S. citizen who's lived in Cuba for a long time. Her son studied medicine in Cuba, so she may have some insights that would be helpful to some of you. Let's go back to the first question.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a sociology graduate who wants to know what?
If I can fast track my application process.
The answer, the shorter answer is yes, you can fast track it. You may not be able to fast track it as fast as you want or think you can, because there's no way to avoid the sciences. So, yes, after having a bachelor's degree in sociology, you still need to go back and get the basic sciences. And keep in mind that you need to have a pretty clearly articulated and strong motivation for that change, because our readers of the applications take a very keen look at motivation for medicine. And one of the questions our staff who answer and the medical committee who read the inquiries you make would say is, if you want to be a doctor, why haven't you taken any science courses? You know, if you wanted to be a doctor, why were you studying yoga and tennis? You can get back in and take the biology, the physics, the chemistries, and you can get yourself ready to go to med school. And maybe, see, the counter argument is maybe you can say, yes, I'll do that, and with my sociology background and all of those other esoteric courses that I've taken, I'll be more well-rounded.